ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Looking at your finances more closely this tax time? On the ABC Business Daily podcast, we break down the stories shaping employment and the economy. And as the financial year comes to a close, we're breaking down what you need to know about super, write-offs, property, and shares in a special tax series. Hear it now. Search ABC Business Daily on ABC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
Madison Connaughton, hello.
Hey, Josh.
We're back for episode 2 of this background briefing mini-series, Beef, Battle of the Blue Zones.
What a title. Yes, we are back.
And last time we spoke, you were telling me about Saul Newman, the researcher who kind of shook the foundations of this idea of blue zones.
There are some extraordinary, unexplained issues. Nobody before me seemed to have any qualms about the blue zones.
It seemed to bring him into conflict with all these different people, including the man who'd made Blue Zones famous, Mr. Blue Zones, Dan Buettner.
Yeah, that's right. And then remember, something interesting happened. Dan actually reached out to Saul and offered him a gig, asking him to help find the next Blue Zone.
I can't remember exactly what I said, but it would have been telling him to stick his face in the north end of a southbound cow kind of response.
So now we've got a full-blown beef. And I want to know more about this Dan Buettner guy.
So this Dan Buettner, that name kept coming up as I was looking into this Blue Zones idea. He's often called an explorer, which I think is probably the best job title I've ever heard.
It is. How do you get a job like that?
Well, it's interesting. He's not a scientist. Dan's more of like, he's this guy who has kind of big ideas and is able to pull them off. The first thing you notice about him, or the first thing I noticed about him, is he's like incredibly charismatic, you know, sort of tall, tanned, athletic everyman. And I don't know, like, have a listen to this, but I think his voice sounds a lot like the actor Steve Carell.
So one of the great fallacies is that you need to be rich to be healthy and live a long time. Blue Zones teach us the absolute opposite.
Before Blue Zones, Dan's main claim to fame was that he actually set a Guinness World Record for cycling the length of North and South America.
And how do you go from the Guinness Book of Records to Blue Zones?
It's a good question. So around the late 90s, Dan started looking into this idea of like, where do people live the longest in the whole world? And he was traveling to some of those places, like Okinawa.
Okay.
And so he kind of jumps from being an adventurer, a world record holder, to a writer. And he's working for National Geographic, which is where he does his first story about the Blue Zones. And that's how the idea starts to take off.
Okinawa, the longest lived people in the history of the world, every time they start a meal, they say hara hachi bu, which is a reminder to stop eating when their stomachs are 80% full.
But while Dan launched Blue Zones into the public consciousness, he didn't do it alone. There was someone working with him.
Oh, okay. Who's that?
So this guy is Michel Poulin.
Michel Poulin.
Michel Poulin is a Belgian demographer, and he's really well regarded in this whole world of verifying the ages of really old people, the stuff we were talking about with Saul in the last episode. Hi, Michel. How are you? Michel jumps on a video call with me from his home office.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
Okay, then I am awake.
And behind him, the walls are just stacked with knickknacks from his travels all around the world. Michel's in his 70s now, and his hair and his beard, I have to tell you, are like this shock of curly white hair. And when we talk, he's wearing this bright blue bowler shirt. And I can't help but thinking he kind of looks like Santa on a beach holiday.
It's a very jolly image.
He was a jolly guy. And he was kind of telling me that more than two decades ago, you know, back before his hair went white, he was studying the oldest people living on the island of Sardinia.
I am the one that discovered the Blue Zones already now 25 years ago in Sardinia. And I put on the map with my blue pen this area.
Michel was marking up a map of Sardinia with a blue marker when he was finding centenarians. And all of these blue marks were concentrated in one part of the island. So he goes, it's the blue zone.
Okay, the blue zones. Not the blue rinse set, but the blue zones.
No, the blue is just because of the colour of the marker. Like, it could have been the green zones if you'd brought a different pen that day.
Oh, wow. Arbitrary.
Yes. Then Dan Buettner comes knocking, and he wants to write a story about this for National Geographic.
My good friend Dan Buettner saw that I published in 2004 an article that we discovered Sardinia is a blue zone. That's why he jumped on us and asked a lot of questions.
So Dan's piece for National Geographic, it comes out the next year in 2005. And it's like this big splashy feature, lots of photos, lots of smiling old people. And the article, it highlights Sardinia as a blue zone, but also two other places. Dan names Okinawa in Japan and Loma Linda in California. So these are the three original blue zones.
Okay.
And Loma Linda, that one kind of raised an eyebrow for Michelle.
I never supported Loma Linda. We have no proof that it's a long-living area.
So Michelle, he doesn't agree Loma Linda is a blue zone. Why does Dan list it in the article then?
Well, Dan's explanation has been that he was told by his editor at National Geographic that he had to find an American blue zone.
Uh-huh.
And his article spotlights these Seventh-day Adventists who live in Loma Linda. You know, really healthy, no smoking, no drinking. And there is research that Adventists do live longer than the average American.
Okay, so what did Michelle think of Loma Linda being included?
Yeah, I actually expected that he might have been a little bit pissed, you know? But when Michelle sees his work in the magazine, he's excited.
That I was able to be mentioned, just mentioned, in an article of National Geographic was very, very attractive.
And I kind of get it, right? Like, he'd worked in this really niche area of science that didn't ever really get any attention. And then suddenly his work is in one of the most popular magazines in the world.
I was a young researcher and National Geographic is very attractive. So at the beginning, I was very, very impressed.
Wow. Okay. So kind of disarmed and seduced by the attention.
Yeah. I mean, this article, it's massive. Like, it goes whatever the 2000s version of going viral was. And then National Geographic comes to Dan and says, we want more blue zones.
So what did he do?
Well, Nat Geo decides to put up a lot of money for Dan to search the world for more blue zones.
And does he go back to Michelle?
He does. And so Michelle, Dan, and this Sardinian doctor named Gianni Pez, they set off on this search. And in the following years, they named two more blue zones. So the Nicoya Peninsula in Costa Rica and our beautiful Greek island, Ikaria.
Ah, yes. I remember you took me there.
And I've got good news, Josh. We're going back to the island.
Welcome to Ikaria, the island of longevity. People on this island are living longer than just about any place else on Earth.
And it's on one of Dan's trips to Ikaria when he meets this man named Stamatis Moraitis.
Stamatis Moraitis.
Yes, very Greek name. Stamatis is a man in his, well, it's not actually clear what his age is. He says he's in his hundreds. His records say he's in his 90s.
Okay.
But he has this incredible story that he shares with Dan, who ends up sharing it with the world.
I wrote a story for the New York Times magazine called The Island Where People Forget to Die and told the story of Stamatis Moraitis.
Dan writes in this story that Stamatis was living in the US in the 1970s when he was given a terminal diagnosis of lung cancer, told that he had just a few months to live. So he decided to move back to the place where he was born, Ikaria. And once he was there, he embraced the Ikarian lifestyle. He's walking everywhere, he's eating local food, he's surrounded by family and friends and community, and he starts drinking, you know, a couple glasses of wine every day.
This is actually where Stamatis makes wine, this huge vat. We'll fill it with grapes. He'll put on boots
and get in and stomp the grapes like Ulysses did until the wine comes out.
According to Dan's article, after Stamatis moves back to the island, something amazing happens. He gets better. His cancer, it just goes away.
And ended up living about 35 more years. And that's just emblematic of the type of things you see here.
Wow, okay. I mean, that sounds like a medical miracle.
Yeah, and look, if you weren't sure, Dan writes in this magazine article that Stamatis never had chemotherapy, never had treatment of any sort. He says all he did was move home to Ikaria.
It's a very seductive idea, isn't it?
Mm.
So what, Dan publishes this New York Times story and it captures the public imagination.
It definitely does. I mean, heaps of other media have done follow-up stories on this, and people still reshare the article even today, including Dan.
And it sounds like Stamatis was kind of like, I'm not going to say poster child, but poster man for Blue Zones?
Yeah, I mean, kind of like a poster centenarian for Blue Zones. But I feel like this is Dan's real superpower, you know, being able to find these inspiring older people like Stamatis who are living in the Blue Zones.
Marge is 104. She starts her day with lifting weights, and then she gets in a root beer-colored 1994 Cadillac Seville and tears down the San Bernardino Freeway, where she still...
And he tells their stories everywhere he goes.
I've been on 19 hardcore expeditions, but I'll tell you, there was no adventure more harrowing than riding shotgun with Marge Chaton.
And the more Dan tells these stories, the more the interest in Blue Zones grows, and the more people are willing to pay to live the Blue Zones lifestyle.
Thank you very much.
So Dan's traveling the world at this point. He's doing all these speeches about Blue Zones. He's definitely become the face of this phenomenon. He's got a book, you know, which features Stamatis' story.
Right.
And the book's a hit. It becomes a New York Times bestseller.
Wow.
Even Oprah's favourite TV doctor, remember Dr. Oz?
Sure do.
So he's spruiking the Blue Zones diet on his show.
Years with your family. And my friend and longevity expert, Dan Buettner, reveals the secrets to living to 100 in his book, The Blue Zones. Now he says it starts...
So Blue Zones is blowing up. Is Dan getting a cut of this?
Well, after he wrote that first National Geographic article, Dan started a for-profit company called Blue Zones LLC.
Okay.
And he also starts selling these Blue Zones branded products.
They drink a little bit of wine mid-morning, mid-afternoon, and at night with meals. It tends to be a little crude because it's homemade there.
He's a pretty skilled entrepreneur.
But I managed to get a hold of these grapes and to blend it in such a way to make an absolutely delicious Cantonal wine. And you can get it online. Just Google Blue Zones wine and we can have it sent to you.
Today, there are Blue Zones cookbooks, hot sauces, frozen meals, meal kits, tea, coffee, tinned beans, online cooking courses. There's even a skincare line and merch. And as the Blue Zones brand takes off and Dan's company grows, Michel Poulin...
That's the guy with the blue marker.
Yes, the guy with the blue marker, the one who invented the term Blue Zone. His feelings start to shift.
I was very, very impressed up to the moment where I discovered that it has become really a business.
And then one day, Michel realizes that not only has Dan started a business...
He decided to trademark the term Blue Zone.
Michelle's shocked that Dan has trademarked Blue Zones.
I was not informed that he got this trademark. He started to go in the direction of business and I progressively decided to stop to work with him.
Okay, so that sounds like the end of things between Michelle and Dan. They break up the band?
Yeah, well, Michelle told me he'd decided to go his own way after this. And last year, he set up a non-profit called Living Blue Zone. But then he says he got an official letter telling him he can't use the name.
What?
Because the term is trademarked.
So now we are starting to find an agreement between us for the use of a term that I introduced now 24 years ago.
So you created this term and now you have to negotiate to use it.
yes, it's amazing.
I did ask Dan for his side of all of this, but he didn't respond to my questions about Michelle. I also asked Michelle about Saul Newman, that Australian researcher who'd criticised Blue Zones.
Okay, here we go.
Honestly, Michelle didn't seem that fazed by Saul. Like, he was very confident about his work, he defended it, but maybe it's just his personality, he's easygoing. Or maybe it's because his focus seems to be on another beef.
Another beef? So what is that?
I am fighting with some colleagues in the US because they want to do Blue Zone everywhere with very simple criterion, and they know that I am very exigent and I will not accept. I will say it's an everyday fighting session.
Remember last episode, we were talking about that group of longevity scientists pushing for a new definition of Blue Zones. Michelle doesn't agree with it.
And I did not accept. I did not accept. This is criterion for a longevity hotspot, but not for a Blue Zone.
But the strange thing is, even though Michelle is telling me he opposes this new definition, he's put his name on an upcoming paper with other Blue Zones researchers that uses it.
Why does he do that?
Yeah, I mean, it struck me as odd. I asked him, why sign on to something you don't agree with?
I have the choice to be inside or not. I decide to be inside better than to go outside and to start to protest.
Why is it better to be inside than outside?
Because I am the father of the Blue Zone. I feel I am the father, and I prefer to be inside to defend my child than to be outside.
Michelle feels like he can better argue against this definition if he's inside the tent. And he's very fired up about this and about the tussle over the trademark.
I will fight with the highest level, and I have now good contact with a lot of journalists and so on, and it will not continue without any battle, okay? Mm. It's a battle for the Blue Zone.
Wow, so the founder and the father of the Blue Zones are beefing.
Yeah, it's pretty fraught. We were sort of talking about a beef between Saul Newman and Dan Buettner, but then I'm like, oh, there's a beef within the beef. Despite the falling out with Michelle, though, Dan forges on with the business. I was actually surprised by how big Dan was able to grow this Blue Zones idea into like a multi-million dollar enterprise.
All right.
We got some insight into this in 2020 when he actually sold Blue Zones LLC to a big healthcare company.
How much did he sell it for?
Well, reportedly, nearly $80 million.
Bang! Brother's making bank.
It's incredible, right? Coming from one National Geographic article to a nearly $80 million company. And one of the reasons that it's worth so much is because of this thing called Blue Zones Project.
Okay, which is?
It's kind of a public health consultancy that Dan has built, where basically the project teams will go into towns and cities and give them advice on how to make the city more Blue Zone-y.
For a fee?
Yes, for a fee.
How's that work? Like, how does a place actually get the stamp of approval for being a Blue Zone?
Well, it seems like the general idea is taking the health lessons that Dan learned on his travels to the Blue Zones and helping these places apply them in their own communities. But how exactly they do that, it was something that I just wanted to know more about. So I tracked down someone who actually ran one of these projects.
I knew about Blue Zones. I knew about Dan Buettner's work.
This is Sarah Henke, and the first time she heard about the Blue Zones project was when she was weighing up whether to move to this small town in America called Brevard.
And then I found out that it was going to become a Blue Zones. And that for me was like, you know, sealed the deal.
Sarah's like a Blue Zones true believer. And once she arrives in Brevard, she's so inspired, she actually applies to work on the Blue Zones project team.
Wow, okay. And do they take her on?
Yeah, she gets the job. So she goes out and works with schools and grocery stores to kind of get them Blue Zones certified. And she told me that the way they did this is each place had to get enough Blue Zones points.
If they had like a water bottle station, that would be 3 points. if they created a policy against sugary beverages in soda machines, that would be a few points.
And she said that once you get enough points, you become like a Blue Zones approved business or school, and you get to put a sticker in your window. But Sarah said that early on, she started seeing cracks in this approach.
Because once they were approved, they were approved. And they could have dropped everything that they did to get that approval the very next week.
Sarah ended up running this Blue Zones project in Brevard, and Brevard became America's 50th Blue Zone certified community.
All right.
But she was left with complicated feelings about the whole thing.
It was a very expensive program.
It cost around $3.4 million. Which Sarah said wasn't even for the whole community. It was just for one zip code. And the money, that had come from a special fund the town had set up after it sold its public hospital a few years earlier.
All right, okay. So the town sold its public hospital and then it saw this Blue Zone certification as one of the things that would keep it healthy.
Yeah, that's right. And running this program, Sarah said she felt like it was only really serving those in the community who
already were shopping at Whole Foods or already going to yoga. The amount of money that we spent for 100 people to be doing those things, like, could we have done that better with less?
While Sarah was there, the Blue Zones projects, they did do things like they ran walking groups and these things they call purpose workshops.
Mm-hmm.
But it's not like they were actually, you know, using this money to build walking paths or things like that. What they were giving was advice. And Sarah says that eventually Brevard decided to go it alone and they set up a nonprofit, which she now runs.
We said, we can do this in our own grassroots way at probably a quarter of the cost.
Sarah says some of the changes Brevard paid so much for, they haven't lasted.
We've got restaurants and schools and stuff that have their stamps on their windows, and none of their policies are still in place.
It's important to say, like, Sarah's experience with Blue Zones, it's just the perspective from one town. These projects have been run in more than 70 cities across the US. And Blue Zones say that they have seen improvements in well-being in places where these projects have rolled out.
Have you asked Dan about it?
Yeah, well, I chased him for a month for an interview. He declined. And to be clear, you know, he wasn't in charge of Blue Zones a lot of the time that this specific project in Sarah's town was running. But he told me in an email that for every one Sarah, there are five people who will attest to the efficacy of Blue Zones. And then he said he'd actually bought back controlling interests in Blue Zones earlier this year, wanting to focus on Blue Zones projects.
Right. Dan's back.
Yeah, he's back. And of course, I wanted to ask him about this. I wanted to ask him about Saul Newman's criticisms, about the beef with Michelle, and about something else, which I discovered in my research.
Oh, okay. What's that?
Well, remember Stomatis Moritis on Ikaria?
Yes. The impish, bright-eyed centenarian.
I just had this bell in my head when I was reading his story because I've had people in my life who have had lung cancer, and it is an incredibly deadly disease.
Mm.
So I got on the phone with a journalist I know who works in Greece. Her name is Daphne Tolis, and she agreed to take on the very tough job of travelling to Ikaria for us.
Well, it's a nice gig to have. What did she find?
Everyone knew of Stamatis Moritis. I spoke to Chrisa, who owns a little cafe, and she said that she remembers Stamatis coming to her house, hanging out with her father. And I said, what do you remember about him? And she said he also drank red wine, that red wine, specific red wine from Ikaria.
Daphne kept asking around the island, and she was trying to find people who knew more about Stamatis.
So I was asking around and they told me, oh, there is his niece. So I went and I knocked on the door and I said, hi, I would like to ask you about your uncle.
Stamatis's niece welcomed Daphne in and she told Daphne the story of her uncle returning to Ikaria after his diagnosis.
Hey,
Then, she said, these 6 months passed, a year passed, and then he was still here. She remembers her uncle saying, hey guys, instead of dying, I'm getting stronger. She believes that it was just his psychology and the fact that he was eating the products that were free of chemicals that he grew.
But then something interesting happened. Daphne found the local doctor there, who'd actually seen Stamatis, and he had a different perspective on his recovery.
He says, no, I don't think he had cancer. I think it was some sort of wrong diagnosis. I don't believe he beat lung cancer.
So Stamatis' doctor's saying he didn't think he had cancer.
Yeah, that's what he said. And so, of course, I wanted to get a second opinion.
I'm Shalini Vinod. I'm a radiation oncologist that specializes in the treatment of lung cancer.
And a third.
Professor Michael Boyer, CEO of Chris O'Brien Lifehouse, and a medical oncologist specializing in lung cancer.
And a fourth.
Stephen Clark, I'm a professor of medicine and a cancer specialist.
I showed them the information that I had on Stamatis from Dan Buettner's article, and all three of them said the same thing.
I suspect he didn't have lung cancer, and that's why he lived a really long time.
I would say he probably never had lung cancer in the first place.
That makes me think that he probably didn't have lung cancer in the first instance.
Right. And why did they think that?
Well, when I asked them whether someone with lung cancer, who's been told they have just months to live, could recover without any treatment, they said,
I've never seen it in my clinical practice in lung cancer, and I've practiced for about 25 years now as a specialist.
Untreated lung cancer has a survival in the region of somewhere between 6 months and 18 months.
They think that this was, in all likelihood, a misdiagnosis.
Right.
And they all had the same theory about why someone like Stamatis might have been misdiagnosed.
In the 70s, the ability to diagnose and treat lung cancer would have been very primordial compared with now. So it would have relied on chest x-rays.
In the middle of my chat with him, Stephen Clark actually spins around his computer and he pulls up one of his patient's lung x-rays on his screen. And he points to something.
A chest x-ray is just front and back and doesn't really show great detail.
It really doesn't look that much different than the other side.
No, and that's part of the problem with chest x-ray, is that it's a pretty primitive device.
He told me that today doctors use way more advanced scans like CT scans and also biopsies to determine whether someone has lung cancer.
Oh yeah, what's that?
Because if you're just relying on a lung x-ray, a lot of things that aren't actually cancer can look like it.
Okay.
Michael Boyer explained it like this.
The shadow of a cancer typically will appear as a white area. So too will the shadow of pneumonia. So too would a fungal infection. You know, there's a whole series of things that have a similar appearance.
And Shalini Vinod, she tells me she thinks
the most likely thing would be an infection.
Okay, so you've got a gaggle of top medical experts who all think the same thing probably happened in the case for Stamatis, as does the local doctor on Ikaria, right?
Yes.
And that possibility of a misdiagnosis, it's not mentioned in Dan's New York Times piece.
No, it's not. And, you know, Michael Boyer said context like that matters.
It's important because if we really want to say in this story, well, here was someone that was told he had cancer, he went back to live his wholesome lifestyle on an island in Greece and his cancer went away, before you can draw any conclusions from that, you've got to be really, really certain that he had cancer in the first place.
Josh, there was this one comment on the story that really caught my eye.
Mm-hmm.
Can I read it to you?
Okay, please do.
He never had chemo or any other toxic so-called treatment for cancer. Smart move.
It worries me that patients with stage 4 lung cancer might read this and think they should shun evidence-based treatment and that by changing their lifestyle, the cancer will disappear by itself.
So what about Dan Buettner? Did he have anything to say about this?
I asked Dan in an email, like, what evidence had he seen before writing about Stamatis' story? You know, did he check medical records? Did he talk to his treating physician? I even asked if he'd sought a second opinion from another doctor. He said in response that the story had been fact-checked by the New York Times.
And what did the New York Times say?
A spokesperson said that Dan's 2012 article was clearly adapted from one of his books and it had met their editorial standards to publish.
Okay.
And she said that they would have fact-checked the story in line with their policies and that it would have been difficult to independently verify Stamatis' cancer diagnosis beyond what he'd told to Dan.
Hmm.
She did add, quote, Mr. Buettner's commercial interests in Blue Zones should have been fully disclosed to readers in this piece.
So that wasn't disclosed?
No, not in the piece.
So Dan wouldn't do an interview with you.
Mm.
We've now heard a lot about the stories and the science behind this longevity phenomenon. Do you think Dan has any doubt about the Blue Zones?
Well, look, looking at his public comments and his socials, I have no doubt that he fully believes in the Blue Zones, particularly that they can teach people how to be healthier. It seems like he lives by these principles himself, and a lot of the Blue Zones advice, you know, things like eating a mostly vegetarian diet or doing regular exercise, minimising the stress in your life, that's all in line with solid health advice.
Yeah, okay.
And I wish I could have talked to him about all of this, what his plans are for Blue Zones now he's bought back in. But I got the sense from his emails that the reason he wouldn't speak to me, at least in part, was because tensions are very high.
Oh.
Saul Newman has a book coming out about his criticisms of the Blue Zones and longevity science. And Dan, he has his own book coming out too.
So the battle of the Blue Zones continues.
It certainly does. Back on Ikaria, some of the local old-timers invited Daphne, our Greek island correspondent, to come sit down with them for a coffee.
They told me they think that, you know, maybe the previous generations did live longer because they had a certain way of life which most don't follow anymore.
There was a certain sense that something had shifted since the island was declared a blue zone.
They said, well, okay, it's been in the media a lot, and we actually now believe that this has jinxed us. They were sort of joking, but also at the same time being serious, that people don't want to be interviewed on this topic because there is like this sort of curse that is placed upon them since the whole Blue Zone matter.
This actually reminded me of something Michel Poulin told me about how he's seen Ikaria change because of tourism and how the older people who are still there, they don't even want to talk to him.
You cannot see any more centenarians, or even me. Last time that I was in Ikaria, I did not see any centenarian.
And this, he said, was his fear about the whole thing.
You will kill your Blue Zone by the fact that you declare it's a Blue Zone. Can you imagine this?
Background Briefing's sound producers are Ingrid Wagner and Kyle Hopkins. Sound engineering by Tegan Nichols. Music composition by Hamish Camilleri. Fact checking by Steve Vivian. Our rollout producer is Ben Sveen. The supervising producer is Gina McEwen. And the executive producer is Max Chalmers. The reporter on this story is Madison Connaughton. And I'm Josh Robertson. To hear more episodes, search for the Background Briefing podcast on ABC Listen or wherever you find your podcasts. Thanks for listening.